then we'll go to the file systems. And soon after, we'll, the last section is the swap. And very briefly, we'll look at the virtual memory and some of the tunables in that. We'll not be covering a lot of swap in VM virtual memory, given it's more of a memory management than I/O. But given that it has significant effect on I/O subsystem, we'll just briefly look at some of the tunables. Before we start with the gathering tool, this is the process in general. I mean, it's, there are three stages: gathering, measuring, and tuning. You gather, you measure it, and then you tune what has to, and if the tuning is right, you have to again gather the performance related data, and then you have to measure it again to see whether your tuning has made it worse or better. So, and then it can go in cycles. It's one of the most important steps, and some of the tools are available in all Linux distros. IOStack, SAR, which gather more IO-specific data, and then there are some generic tools, VMStat, TOP, or Strace if you are interested in the number of read, write, and what sort of parameters the application is passing with the read and write system calls. Now, the data you gather from these tools can be stored in text, CSV, or database or something else. And it depends on what you want to do with that data. So it's again your choice. Now it also depends on the graphing tool you use to measure the performance, I mean, to plot the charge. That tool, I mean, if it works well with text or CSVs or the database. Now, going on to the IOStat. Now, IOStat, without any parameters, will just give you the average utilization or the average figures since the last system reboot. And so in the first line, it's the average CPU, and it has a very clear breakdown of how much time the CPU has spent doing different things. What we are more interested in is the block device statistics. So it will give you nicely, I mean, what are block devices are there on the system, and what are transactions per second that particular block device is doing, and how those transactions per second convert to the blocks read per second, blocks written per second to the block device, and the total number of blocks read and written to the device. Now, what you do with that data is again up to you. I mean, you can divide the block read per second, written per second by transaction per second to calculate what are the number of blocks on average per transaction. Or SAR minus B will go a bit further in breaking down the transaction per second to read and write transaction per second. Now, again, I've not collected these statistics on my laptop running, so it was not that much. VMStat, again, is not directly related to IO subsystem, but it will give a holistic view of what different subsystems are doing. And in this example, in the first line is a summary since last system reboot. You can see number of blocks in and out. And at the same time, you can see what was the average CPU utilization doing different things, and how and what effect that had on the memory system and the swap in and out. So, TOP again, it's a basic tool for interactive view of different processes, how they are related, and what is the resource utilization on a whole. So moving on to the next section, IO elevators. This is the section we'll be spending a bit more time than the last section. Now, IO subsystem is the slowest system of all, and that's why it's the most tunable system, and that's why that's the reason I picked up the system for the presentation today. Now, workload determination is very important, and you need to know what you're tuning the system for, because there's no one good tuning parameter. Like for TCP stack tuning, you can tune the system mostly, by fine-tuning some of the parameters, and it will work for most of the people. But there's no such tuning parameter for IO subsystem. It depends a lot on your workload. So you have to know what kind of workload you'll be running on the system, what sort of read and write patterns it has, what is the percentage of read versus percentage of write. If it's sequential or random. So you need to know your workload very well. And some of the tools we discussed in the last section will help you to determine that. Now, we'll be looking at more specifically the IO algorithms and the tunables in that, known as elevators. Now, they're named so because they work pretty much the same way as an elevator will work in a tall rise building, where floors are different sectors, and people coming in and out of the elevator are the read and write requests. And it has to fine tune the algorithm, and it has to stop at the right floor at the right time. Just minimize the delays. So before tuning the elevators, it's very important that you know your workload. And again, like I said, an incorrectly configured elevator can do more harm on the system than it can benefit. Now, starting with the first in kernel 2.4, when it was first introduced, elevator Linus, it had a very simple algorithm. Each request had a sequence number associated with it. And then there was a default for read request and write request. So for write request, the default is 8192. And for read request, the default is 2048. So every time there's a read or a write request, the kernel will put it in the dispatch queue. At the same time, it will decrease the sequence number by one. Now, it relies heavily on the transaction. So a read request will be serviced. Before 2048 transactions, definitely. And a write request will be serviced before 8192 transaction. But there's no way to tune the expiry time for the read or the write request in this algorithm, and that was the major drawback of this. You can tune it on 2.4 kernel system using ELFTune, which lets you set the read and the write latency of the request, the default ones. Now with kernel 2.6, because of the drawbacks of elevator Linus, there were four new elevators introduced: completely fair queuing, CFQ, deadline, anticipatory, and no off. You can pass elevator equal to deadline, AS, CFQ, or no off to set the default elevator of the system. Now, as you have to pass this during the kernel booting time or on in grub.conf, it is a system-wide setting. So you cannot have a per block device algorithm. But the tunables are per block device. So same system running 10 different block devices, and if you have different application writing to different block devices, you can tune per block device for that elevator. Now the first one, CFQ, completely fair queuing, is the default one for most of the distributions in use today. And it will assign the incoming request to a specific queue based on the process. So each process will have its own dispatch queue, will have its own queue, and the dispatcher will pick up the request four at a time from each queue and put it in the dispatch queue. So it's a very simple algorithm, and it guarantees fairness at a per process level. And Then the tunable for CF power quantum, total number of requests which are placed in the dispatch queue per cycle, and queued, which has changed since I made these slides, but in the latest release, there are also tunables related to expiry time of the request, the batch expiry and those things. But then you can tune these things on a per block device on the system. Deadline is the next one. It was written to cause, because of the starvation caused by elevator liners, and it has an expiry associated with each request. Now, again, the algorithm is a very simple one. For each incoming request, it will assign it to a queue base, which is sorted based on the physical sector of the disk. And at the same time, it will insert that request into the second queue, which is based on whether it's a read request or a write request. And then it will put the request from the first queue directly to a dispatch queue until the read or the write queue, the top request of that, expires. And then it will immediately start serving the read or the write request queues. So that way it guarantees that all the requests will be served within a given time frame. Now the deadline tunables, again, is read expire and write expire. And that is the time by which the request will be handled by the system. FIFO batch is the number of requests to batch process once it comes to the FIFO queue. So it will process that many requests in a given time. By default, the number is 4. So it will take 4 at the top 4 requests. And the preference of read over write. So you can configure that in the deadline tunable. Anticipatory is the next one. Now, anticipatory is to minimize the read delays at the expense of global throughput. And it does that by waiting for the second read or another read after it has completed one. So it will read, and then it will wait for a few milliseconds before moving to another sector of the disk for the application to issue another write to read. Now, it is useful for applications or workloads with many dependent reads. And again, it has tunables which will let you configure the read expiry, the expire time and the write expire time, and also in batches. And then the most important parameter here is antique expire, which is the millisecond delay or the time it will wait after one read. By default, that is 3 milliseconds. So it will wait for 3 milliseconds after each read in that disk area for another read to be issued by the application. So if your workload has that kind of characters, you can use that. NOOP is the final one. As the name suggests, it will absolutely, no operation, it will directly place the request to the dispatch queue and directly to the hardware. And it will let the hardware decide what is the best way to process the request. So if your hardware is intelligent enough, if you are probably using RAM disk or native command queuing at the hardware level, or if your workload is like that. Coming to the next section, file systems. Now in file system, we'll be covering the VFS subsystem layer, file system tunables, a few of them, tuning for the software RAID, fragmentation and journaling issues. So VFS simply in Linux, the way it happens is you have the system call, right, which is then translated to the syswrite, which is a VFS system call, VFS call, and then it gets translated to the file system's native write call. So that's why you can plug different file systems. You can have you have a choice of so many file systems you can use with the same system call write, and it will then physically it will deal with the media, physical media. Now the file system tunables. You can have, at the time of the creation, you can configure the block size. Now, the block size, it depends again on your workload. what block size will benefit you the most. So a request goes through different layers, and you would like to see that the block size across different layers are the same, so that you maximize the performance and the system doesn't spend too much time breaking the request into multiple transactions. So you need to have a consistent block size from top to bottom. At the same time, block size, normally, the bigger the block size, normally the better the performance is. Because it also relates to fragmentation issues. I mean, it helps you resolve a lot of them. Number of inodes is another thing. I mean, you have to characterize your workload and see if your workload will be creating a lot of files, small files, big files. Will you run out of inodes or not? And at the file system creation time, you can have the reserve space tuned. And you can have some of the journaling options, which we'll see in a minute. Software rate tuning. Now, this is specific to EXT3 file system, that you can configure the stride size so that you maximize the performance. While creating the file system on a software rate device, you can use -R option to have a stride which, so you'll write the data to the RAID device in that way. So I mean, one stride should cover all the chunks of your RAID device. Fragmentation. Now, fragmentation will increase the time taken for sequential reads. And the larger the block system size, we have discussed that, there's a less chance of fragmentation, but there's wasted space. And the smaller the block system size, you'll save space, but fragmentation can still happen if the files are deleted and then those blocks are allocated later on. In EXT3, there's block pre-allocation. So at the time of you start creating a file, it will pre-allocate 8 block groups to that file, and will only release those blocks once your file is committed to a disk and you have finished editing. So that will guarantee some sort of contiguous sort of allocation. Now, the journaling operation normally will go like this. It will write the modified blocks to the journal, then the modified blocks are written to the file system, and finally, the journal entries are dropped. There are 3 modes which you can use, and again, by using the first mode, journal, it will be the slowest because you are writing both the data blocks and the metadata in the journal, and it will be the slowest. The second one is the default one, again, for most of the distribution, in which only the, when the data blocks are written to the file system, the data region, then the metadata is written to the journal. So you have some sort of consistency there. Or you can use write-back, which is the fastest, and if your workload supports, you can go with that, but in that, metadata is written to the journal before committing the actual data blocks to your disk. So you might have some inconsistency there, and it then depends, you have to just balance off that. You can just mount it with a data equal to option to use one of the 3 modes. The placement is, again, another thing which will determine how your system performs. Internal is default, but if you have it on external partition or a external disk spindle or another disk spindle, you can get a better performance by at least 10% or so. You can create it using makefs. The block size should match. I mean, again, that is the journal and the data block file system, block size should match. So the mount option by which you can increase the performance, you can mount it with no access time updates. It will not update access time flags in the inode every time it accesses a file. Most of the application are all right with that, but if your application is not, you have to again find that in the gathering phase. And you can have a longer delay between the commit from the time it is writing the journal and actually committing. Between A-time and? Not aware of that. So which one is that? C-time, M-time, A-time? But then still, it still has to maintain that record somewhere.
Yeah, but that's low frequency icon, that's where it's pretty
cool. All right. Yeah, so that's an option worth looking then. All right, excellent. All right, or a join. So that's a new option. By using, by mounting it with minus O, no RA time, or with RA time? Real time, all right. Now moving onto the last section, swaps and buffer and page cache. Swap and buffer and cache are not directly related to IO subsystem, but still is related to the IO subsystem because it affects the performance of IO subsystem. It can be a disk or a file up to 32 areas, 64 GB, per area. Now some of the consideration which it should be initialized with make swap if you're using that swap in Linux. Using disk swap rather than file-based swap is a better option always. If it is spread across multiple disk spindles, again, it's better than having it all on one disk. And lower number partition just so that it has lower seek time. It is closer on the inner cylinders of the disk. And if you have faster disk and slower disk at the same time for swap, assign higher priority to the faster disk. And the same priority disk are always round-robin in Linux. So the tunables in swap, again, it determines how much swapping will be done in kernel 2.4 and 2.6, there are different tunables. I'm just going to rush that through very quickly. And the page and buffer cache. Now, write frequency is handled by the page and buffer flushing threads. In kernel 2.4 and 2.6, they're different. It has undergone the modification, so I mean, they're different tunables. You can also configure the read ahead window sizes by configuring these parameters in kernel 2.4 and 2.6. Again, the algorithm is very dynamic, so it will just take these value as a basic guide and then it will adjust the read ahead window size depending on how many heads you have from that cache. Or you can go with direct IO if your application does its own caching and like database or application which support intimate shared memory. So and that with the question is, depending on the workload type, will you select the file system type? Yeah, definitely if you have a read-only workload, there's no point going with a journaling file system. It adds at least 5 to 10% overhead. So you'll go with a EXT2, and then you'll optimize your scheduler, and you'll select the scheduler which supports the read-only better than write. Any other questions? A lot of things working in the EXT3 in the background. So, yeah. Any other question? Yeah?
Do you have any statistics or recommendation for the block size for the web server, which contains lots of small files, and the file server maybe may contain more large files?
Normally, I mean, if you have studied your workload and if you have no reason again to go other than 4K, then go with 4K size. But if you have done, and if your workload supports, say, 1K block size, then it will work better because all your files are 1K, and there's no point going with a 4K block size, then go with 1K. So, but by default, go with 4K to maximize performance in most of the workloads. I mean, that's the default anyway.
Well, that's quite handy because there's a magic networking incantation we give when we're inside an audience that isn't networking people. We put up this thing that's called the OSI 7-layer protocol stack, which, and I feel that since we have this moment that we should repeat it, just in case it has some magic effect. And is Ryan first? First?
Good, cool.
Excellent. Okay. So physical, link, network, transport, which is what we're talking about today, session, presentation, application, and look, even the lights went out. Okay, I suppose you want to know what I'm doing here because I'm what's in the trade known as a router head. I don't do system admin apart from this one Linux box.